Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and whew, it's been a busy day already. President Obama and former Vice President Dick Cheney squared off in dueling national security-themed speeches today. President Obama spoke after yesterday's vote in Congress, in which Democrats joined Republicans in stripping away the funding he'd need to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center and move prisoners out, possibly to the U.S. Obama, who's for weeks been hammered by Republicans on this issue, is trying to recover lost ground. In his speech this morning, he said that some detainees would be tried in federal courts, others in improved but revamped military tribunals. Some would end up in U.S. prisons, and he said no one has ever escaped a U.S. supermax facility. But he also said that a system to handle the worst of the worst has not been set up yet.
This is the toughest single issue that we will face. We're going to exhaust every avenue that we have to prosecute those at Guantanamo who pose a danger to our country. But even when this process is complete, there may be a number of people who cannot be prosecuted for past crimes, in some cases because evidence may be tainted, but who nonetheless pose a threat to the security of the United States.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney delayed the start of his speech until after Obama finished, then launched into a defense of the Bush administration policies and warned Obama that he'd be making a mistake if he brought the worst of the detainees here.
I think the president will find upon reflection that to bring the worst of the worst terrorists inside the United States would be cause for great danger and regret in the years to come.
We're going to talk about the politics of the day in a few minutes, but first, the national security duel of words. Dimitri Savastopoulou is Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. Dimitri, first of all, your sense of how this debate was carried out today.
Robin, it's very interesting. I mean, President Obama has laid out a strong defense for what he wants to do to try and close Guantanamo, as he faces some internal opposition in his own government and also increasing opposition from politicians on Capitol Hill. And he essentially said there are five categories of prisoners at Guantanamo. Some will be tried in U.S. courts. Others will be brought before military commissions, which he stressed would be restructured from the tribunals that the Bush administration tried to use over the last 7 years. He said he would try and transfer 50 detainees to other countries. He said there's a category of 21 detainees that U.S. courts have already ordered should be released because they shouldn't be in captivity. And that includes the 17 Chinese Uyghurs that we've been talking about in recent weeks. But the most difficult one is, he said, there's a group of people who might need to be kept in detention indefinitely because they can't be prosecuted. For example, the evidence against them may be tainted. And that's where he's going to have most problems, and I think human rights and civil rights groups are already criticizing that effort, essentially saying this is a kind of a new form of the indefinite detention that President Bush pursued.
Well, and then the criticism from the right and from some in his own parties is, where would they go? We've already heard people saying, not in my backyard, not in my state, not in my prison. And Dick Cheney really attacked that point today. He said the step to close Guantanamo came with little deliberation, no plan. The idea now, and I'm paraphrasing him, to bring some of these hardened terrorists into the U.S. is one that I find myself completely in agreement with many of the president's own party. And he says this is going to be the biggest mistake to bring the worst of the worst terrorists into the U.S. This is the one that polls show that Republicans have gotten a little brush fire going on. People have a fear that these worst of the worst coming to the U.S. prisons because they can't be tried are going to end up on their streets.
Well, it has. I mean, it's a kind of a fear-mongering technique that has gotten some steam and some support around the country. President Obama essentially preemptively hit back against that, and he said no prisoner has ever escaped from a supermax prison in the U.S. And one of the things that U.S. politicians are saying, we don't want to take any of these people, and they're trying to encourage, for example, Europe to take some of the detainees. And Europeans are saying, well, hold on a second, if you aren't willing to take these detainees because you think they're too dangerous, why should we take them? And so there's a real political conundrum here. And I think actually the writing on the wall was there about 2 years ago when there was a vote in the Senate. I think it was roughly 97-0. I might be a little bit off on that. Where senators said, we don't want any detainees in our backyard. And so the question is, if the U.S. is going to proceed to close Guantanamo, it's going to have to bring some detainees into the U.S. There's just no way around it.
Dimitri, again, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times, Who do you think, after today's speech, got their point across the strongest?
I think in some ways Dick Cheney's speech probably got his point across because it was, I think, shorter and more succinct and to the point. I think President Obama had a more difficult task in that it's a very complex problem, and he was trying to lay out a kind of almost an illegal argument how he would deal with it, and that's a difficult thing to do in soundbites. So I think probably easier for former Vice President Dick Cheney, but I think President Obama at least made a clear attempt to explain what he wanted to do.
Dimitri Savastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, let's take a look now at just how complicated this issue is as the Obama administration tries to deal with it. Let's turn to attorney Brent Mickum, who represents Abu Zubaydah, one of the most notorious Guantanamo detainees. He's accused of being, but not charged with being, a senior al-Qaeda member and facilitator. Brent Mickum previously represented three British detainees who have been released and are at home in Britain. Brent, the Obama administration says something has to be done. Guantanamo is not a problem he created. It's a problem he has to solve. Let's talk about your client. The Los Angeles Times today reports that a senior administration official said that some form of detention without trial was likely because, with some of the suspects, most of the evidence was received under coercive interrogation. Do you think that means your client, Abu Zubaydah?
I actually don't think that about my client. I think that it's much more likely that they could be referring to someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But here's what I can tell you about my client. My client was never even a member of al-Qaeda, much less a high-level member of al-Qaeda.
Hold on a second. The government does say Abu Zubaydah was a senior al-Qaeda operative. He was being watched, they say, before 9/11. Let me just get through it. He was convicted in absentia in 2000 for his role in bomb plots in Jordan. And an FBI agent testified recently that after your client was captured post-9/11, that agent did get intelligence from him before he was waterboarded by the CIA, and the intelligence he got was that Sheikh Mohammed was the mastermind of 9/11. To the government, that says if he knew that, he was connected to al-Qaeda.
I can tell you categorically that the camp that my client was allegedly associated with, Khaldun, was closed by the Taliban in 2000 after it refused repeated demands by the Taliban to fall under the control of al-Qaeda. They closed the camp rather than allow it to fall under the control of al-Qaeda.
So you're saying your client was anti-al-Qaeda?
That is absolutely correct. The camp, and we will be able to put on witnesses to this effect, the camp disallowed the discussion of politics.
Well,
I mean, this is a long-standing camp that existed actually to fight the communists and then the communist insurgents.
This will be your defense, we can hear, of your client, Abu Zubaydah. Again, we have an FBI agent testifying that he received intelligence from your client regarding Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of 9/11. But let's just push it forward. Is your client, you say that's how you're going to defend him. Is your client going to get a trial?
I don't know. He hasn't been charged, think about this. This goes back to your last question, that you are contending that he is a high-level al-Qaeda member.
The government is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
If that were so, why hasn't he been charged as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has, as al-Nashiri has?
Well, this is the tail chasing that's going on right now, and this is the problem that the Obama administration is trying to figure out. Just a hypothetical question. If you think, as you sound that you do, that your client is completely innocent, if he were put on trial in the United States and freed, would you want him in your neighborhood?
Well, I mean, if he were, based on what I know of him, and I have to be very careful here because anything my client tells me is presumptively top secret SCI. I can tell you that, I found him to be a very engaging fellow who has some real memory issues because of a head injury he sustained in 2000 in a mortar explosion, and if that has been exacerbated by his torture. He's had over 200 seizures since he was taken to Guantanamo in 2006.
And we should say intelligence papers show that he was waterboarded repeatedly.
You talk about the one FBI agent, who's Ali Soufan, who says he gave information regarding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I'm quite confident that bin Laden's driver, who's free, probably had information about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as well. I mean, the fact of the matter is, people knew who these people were. My guy was a clerk. Former FBI agent Dan Coleman has reported that my guy was certifiable. He's read his diaries and says he speaks in three distinct different voices and described him as a greeter. He said he was like Joe Louis at Caesar's Palace. You know, you ask me, would I be willing to have him live in my country if he were found to be innocent in my neighborhood? The answer is yes. I can tell you that my former clients, who are British residents, Bishr al-Rawi, Jamil al-Banna, I would be delighted if they lived in my neighborhood. They were always innocent.
Well, you would like to see your client charged or released, if he is charged, given a fair trial. But in the meantime, do you agree with the Obama administration that there are other detainees for whom there may not be anything but tainted intelligence, but who can't be released because they are dangerous?
I will concede that there are individuals who are dangerous, who the government has compromised the case to such an extent that they may not be triable. I don't know that I agree that you can keep those people without charging them and trying them.
Well,
I got involved in these cases early on because I believed it was wrong to hold people indefinitely without charge. That's why I got involved. Let me throw the question back at you. What would you say of a person who was innocent when picked up, but because of his torture and treatment these many years, has become so hardened against the United States that he you know, assures his captors that he will go back to the battle?
Well, the New York Times reports today that an unreleased Pentagon report will say that about 1 in 7 of the 534 prisoners already transferred abroad from Guantanamo have returned to terrorism or militant activities.
I've been disappointed in the Obama administration that they've allowed the Republicans to essentially revivify the fear-mongering that was so prevalent during the Bush administration. And, you know, hopefully they will get through their review of these cases fairly quickly and be able to come back and make some definitive comments about the type of individual who is still down there.
Brent Mickum, the civilian attorney for Guantanamo detainee Abu Zubaydah, joining us on the line from Washington. Brent, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, just ahead, the politics of the day. President Obama attacked the Bush administration policy of even opening Guantanamo Bay, but former Vice President Dick Cheney faulted the Obama administration on a range of issues, for instance, changing the name of the war on terror, but also, as Cheney said, downplaying it. We'll hear the political war of words in just a minute. And later in the program, tracking swine flu, does Wisconsin have more cases than any state in the nation because they're doing better detective work? Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. As we've been hearing, President Obama and former Vice President Dick Cheney sparred today in competing speeches on national security. President Barack Obama defending his decision to close the Guantanamo prison and promising to work with Congress to develop a system for imprisoning detainees who can't be tried and can't be turned loose but would be brought to the U.S. Former Vice President Dick Cheney saying he doesn't hesitate to draw a sharp contrast between the administrations, saying the Obama administration has prided itself on a tendency to search for the middle ground when it comes to terrorism.
But in the fight against terrorism, there is no middle ground. And half measures keep you half exposed. You cannot keep just some nuclear-armed terrorist out of the United States. You must keep every nuclear-armed terrorist out of the United States. Triangulation is a political strategy, not a national security strategy.
Let's bring in Mark Halperin, editor-at-large and senior political analyst for Time magazine, also political analyst for ABC News. Mark, first, your thoughts on the morning.
Well, pretty dramatic and pretty substantive. Unfortunately, I think they talked a little bit past each other. both of these gentlemen and their camps are very aware of the politics and the political stakes. Both can seize on things where they believe they have both the political and substantive advantage. But I do think they talked a little bit past each other in terms of what they wanted to emphasize.
Well, and give us some sense of where you hear that.
Well, you know, it sounded a lot like Barack Obama from the campaign, trying to make the argument that his policies are not just morally right and things needed to be done to restore America's standing in the world, but making the argument, appealing to many Americans, that his ideas and his policies will make America safer, even if they do run counter to some of the harder line policies of the Bush administration. But I think the vice president wants to make the argument, and kind of cherry-picking and doing it, that that some of the policies the president has pursued, in his view, would make America less safe, and to defend America's policies under 8 years of his government.
Now, here are some of their words. Barack Obama saying, as we said, that some detainees would have to be imprisoned in the U.S. if Guantanamo Bay closed down, a very few, but that they couldn't be tried because the evidence against them was tainted, a direct jab at the Bush administration's interrogation techniques. He also said nobody's ever escaped from one of our supermax prisons, which hold hundreds of convicted terrorists already, a jab at sort of the campaign by the Republicans to fearmonger, to raise fear in people that these terrorists will be walking among them. Cheney, on the other hand, saying that President Obama's decision to close Guantanamo came with little deliberation and no plan, and that bringing these hardened prisoners to the U.S., these terrorists to the U.S., if they are released, if they're treated too leniently, they will cut a straight path back to their prior line of work and will conduct murderous attacks in the Middle East, and he says several already have. So, you know, the swords are out.
Well, they are, and again, you know, you can talk about both the politics of it and the policy separately, but I think the reality is the missing piece of this that wasn't as discussed by either man as I think should have been is where we are headed is, for at least some of these people in Guantanamo, is military tribunals or special courts that will try them in a way that I think actually in the end will be perfectly satisfactory for both Dick Cheney and Barack Obama.
And by the way, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the question is how they get set up. And on the other issue you raised just really quickly, it is a bit of a straw man for the president, I think, to raise. Most of these members of Congress, the ones who aren't demagoguing, are not concerned that these people will somehow be in their neighborhoods in a way that they'll break loose, but rather that their communities could become targets of terrorists if they're held locally in their neighborhoods. I think that's a legitimate concern that hasn't really been worked out yet.
Well, and the president said he's going to work with Congress, and we mentioned this yesterday on the program. The state of Montana, for instance, people in one town there say that they have a state-of-the-art facility where some of these detainees could be housed. But what about Vice President Cheney, former Vice President Cheney's conclusion that some of the low-risk detainees who had already been released have gone back and gone back into the business of terrorism? Your thoughts on the report in the today's New York Times that 1 in 7 Guantanamo detainees transferred abroad has returned to terrorism? That's 74 out of 534 prisoners. We just heard from a lawyer who questions that number, but does Dick Cheney have some traction there?
Well, he's got less traction than you might think because, of course, those people were released under the Bush administration. So for the Democrats who want to make the argument that Dick Cheney has no credibility or standing to argue, we kept you safe and this administration won't, that's a question about their policies and their judgment. There are very relatively few people at Guantanamo. This is not tens of thousands of people. And I think what you're going to see this administration do, because the president clearly is worried politically about the accusations that he's not making these balances in the right way, is to try to go through these people one by one, not in a cookie-cutter way, but in a careful way, to say which ones maybe should be sent to other countries, which ones need some sort of military tribunal, and perhaps in some cases which ones should be released. But I think the ones that we're down to, and given the military and political posture of the Obama administration, I wouldn't expect a wholesale release of these people, particularly given the New York Times story you referred to.
But we're talking politics more than strategy and national security, although they are intertwined. But just staying with politics, what do you think the fallout from today is going to be?
Well, you're going to see Republicans decide whether they want to rally behind Dick Cheney's banner. As you know, as your listeners know, there's real ambivalence within the Republican Party about whether Dick Cheney's the right spokesperson for them, the best person they can find. He does have credibility. He does command attention of the public and the press. That's a positive. He's not very popular, and it's very easy for Democrats to demonize him and by association, the Bush-Cheney policies. On the other hand, the president does feel some political vulnerability there, and I, you know, this is a little bit of tea leaf reading, but I think you saw in his posture today more uncertainty, less a black and white assuredness that he knows what the right thing to do is, and that he's feeling his way through this, and you've seen that reflected in some of the policies he's taken, positions he's taken, which are different than what he talked about during the campaign.
Well, you mentioned the polls, and Dick Cheney's poll numbers were so low they could only go up, but they have inched up just a little bit in the last couple of days, so we'll see what happens. Mark Halperin, editor-at-large and senior political analyst for Time Magazine and ABC News. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in, well, after the news, with more of everything that's going on this busy day, here and now. April foreclosures were up 32% over last April, so as we've repeatedly heard, that means more abandoned homes, overgrown lawns, mosquito-infested swimming pools, broken windows. Well, now, one California city has made that neglect illegal. Indio, California, about 120 miles northeast of San Diego, passed a law whereby all abandoned properties have to be registered with the city and maintained, or else the owner, in many cases an out-of-town bank, faces fines that could surpass $25,000 and also face a criminal misdemeanor charge. Other towns in the area have laws. Chula Vista has fined banks since 2007. In neighboring Palm Springs, there's an ordinance that fines lenders up to $1,000 a day, and if they don't pay, a tax lien is put on the home. But the police chief in Indio says he's going further. He will arrest the bank CEOs if they don't pay the fines. Police Chief Brad Ramos joins us. And Chief Ramos, have you arrested anyone yet?
No, not yet. Amazingly, we are getting compliance, and we're finding that the compliance, when we make a phone call to the bank's chairman of the board or the CEO and actually talk to their office, we're getting a response within less than 24 hours in some cases and no more than a day and a half in other cases.
I'm amazed that you're getting through because, again, to underscore, these are not, you know, this isn't the local bank down the street where you know the chairman of the board. These are the big banks that bundled a lot of these mortgages, right?
That's correct, and that's part of the problem we have is it takes some good investigative work from our people to find out who actually owns it. In the beginning, about a year and a half ago, we had some trials and errors being passed from one call center to another call center, and now we're just going right to the corporate office and getting the answers that we need.
So what are these conversations like? Hi, I'm the police chief from Indio, California.
You know, I'll personally call and say, you know, I'd like to speak to whoever the responsible party is for the corporation, say that I'd like to speak about a criminal matter because I don't want to embarrass the bank and I don't want to embarrass the bank president or CEO that he'll have an arrest warrant for a misdemeanor violation in Indio, California. And that tends to get the attention and the results that we're looking for in our community.
We understand that there was a pool full of algae on Eagle Bend Court and Citigroup paid over $3,000 in fines to the town. Can you give us some other examples?
Well, yeah, some other examples is U.S. Bank was notified on one particular property, and within a day and a half they had a crew out there securing it, getting the local property management company to make sure that it stays maintained. The other component that we have on this process is that we're working with realtors and property management companies and have told them that if you bring the property into this program and you bring it up to the neighborhood standard and you don't let it get neglected, we are finding those homes are going for $10,000 to $25,000 more as opposed if it was a straight foreclosure or short sale just by maintaining the property, keeping the grass up, making sure that there isn't any damage. So we've made it a win for the real estate realtors that are in the area, and it makes it much more attractive for a bank to unload that property if it's in the program,
right,
and it's actually getting more money for it.
Well, Police Chief Brad Ramos, again from Indio, California, we understand that your area is one of the highest in foreclosures in the country. Just, I was in Palm Springs and saw a development with five houses standing and about 300 foundations. the developer had gone out of business. A lot of tough scenes there. Can you, if you could just paint a picture for people outside the county to get an idea of why you feel you had to take this step? How bad is it? What are you seeing?
Well, what I was concerned about is I didn't want to become the new Rust Belt in the Sun Belt. We didn't want to have the overgrown yards. We didn't want to have broken, you know, windows, doors that were taken off. And give you an example, we have 26,000 single-family homes, and our city is about 84,000 people. Of those, a year ago in January of 2008, 4% of our housing stock was in pre-foreclosure or foreclosure. In January of 2009, that had gone to 8%. Mm. So right now I have about 1,000 homes that are in foreclosure, pre-foreclosure, and about 500 that are that we've identified as being vacant and that we have registered under the program.
That's Indio, California Police Chief Brad Ramos. He is enforcing an ordinance that requires banks to take care of foreclosed properties or get a call from him and even be arrested. Chief Ramos, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin, and have a good day.
Okay, back in 30 seconds with one city's attempt to track swine flu here and now. Swine flu has moved off the front pages, but it has not gone away, claiming its 10th victim in the U.S. yesterday. 21-year-old Marcos Sanchez died in Salt Lake City, Utah. Health officials say he was more susceptible to the flu because he was overweight and had other medical problems. So that's Utah. But which state would you guess has the most swine flu cases? Well, it's Wisconsin with 885. The state has better tracking facilities than some other states with 5 working labs. But Milwaukee Health Commissioner Bevin Baker says that's just part of the equation.
We believe that maybe the disease got to Milwaukee earlier than other areas of the country, and that this illness was very mild and it may not have been noticed at first. And I think the thing that we're reiterating over and over to our community is that the disease is prevalent here. And you're more likely to get it from someone who's been here and never traveled than you would from someone who's been outside of the country.
Well, the number of cases in Milwaukee has tripled in the past 3 weeks. The person responsible for monitoring how it's spreading and where is Angie Hagee, an infectious disease epidemiologist and the city's head flu tracker. Angie, how do you track flu?
Labs, healthcare providers report to us about cases that they are diagnosing. We also use less traditional sources to try to get a sense of how much flu is in the community because we know only a small percentage of people get sick enough to go to the doctor, and a smaller percentage of those are sick enough to be tested. So we look at things like emergency department visits for influenza-like illness. We look at absenteeism data. We look at over-the-counter drug sales for fever reducers to try to get a much better picture of the amount of disease circulating.
Well, we understand it's half detective work, half, you know, medical know-how. Take us through the first case of swine flu. It appeared in Milwaukee on April 28th. Now, when you got that case, where were we in the CDC's information flow about swine flu and the knowledge of the cases in Mexico? And then how did you begin tracking that first case?
When the first case was reported to us, it wasn't very clear what the severity of disease was. There was a lot of rumor, conjecture coming out of Mexico. There weren't a lot of lab-confirmed cases. There was a lot of hospitalization, not a lot of testing to back that up. So we really didn't have a good picture of what kind of virus we were dealing with. So we were very aggressive in our initial case and contact investigation to try to identify where this person could have gotten sick. At that time, the emphasis was on travel to Mexico, a couple of states in the U.S. where there were cases. There was nothing really even in our region yet.
There was a story recently in the Boston Globe about a swine flu tracker here. Very dramatic. At one point, she was at Logan Airport briefing officials there on what they should look for. She's got beepers on her. The beeper goes off, alerting her to the fact that a swine flu case had been found in a Harvard dental school student. She races to Harvard to talk to officials there about how soon and when they should close down the clinic. Do you see that kind of drama on the ground with your trackers out in the field?
I would say yes. There's a lot of people who were very desperate for information early on. Quickly within the city, the number of cases rose very dramatically. So there were many calls from schools, from childcare facilities, from businesses, saying that they have a case or thought they had a case. What should they do? Who can come to work or school? Who can't come to work? Early on when we were trying to identify the number of schools, it would seem like we'd just get to a point where we had figured out which schools we need to close, where somebody would come to me and say, okay, I have this case, and here's where their contacts go to school, and all their contacts are symptomatic, and we'd go back and forth and try to verify who was in school, were they symptomatic at the time, and we'd be scrambling every day to try to figure out exactly the schools that needed to be closed so that way we could give the notification to the schools, to the parents, to the children that school will not be occurring the next day. So it seems like there was just a flood of information coming in early on about all the cases.
It's like having all the puzzle parts but not knowing what the puzzle looked like yet.
Right.
I just want to ask you about the school closings in Milwaukee. We know at the very beginning of the outbreak, about 20 schools were closed due to swine flu. The health department in Milwaukee decided to reopen the schools on May 5th, in part because of the new CDC guidelines saying you didn't have to close schools. But at the time that that happened, there were only 93 cases of the H1N1 virus in the city. Today, there are, as we said, over 600. So do you think that reopening the schools was not maybe not the right thing to do? Did it lead to more cases?
I think the severity of the disease that we're seeing was fairly low. We very early on realized that we were only spawning a small number of cases. So to continue to close school for the one case you know about and not close school for the 20 or 30 cases you didn't know about seemed like it was somewhat arbitrary on what we were doing.
In other words, you knew that there were cases in schools where you hadn't even found them yet. So
right. The more we looked, the more we found. And it was clear that people weren't getting severely ill. Mm-hmm. The disease was spreading fairly easily, but, you know, our hospitalization rate remained low.
Right. And how does it look for you when you map this out? Do you literally have a map on the wall where you can see cases as they're reported and notice where clusters are? Or is it on computer? I mean, how do you actually see it?
Well, we use an electronic disease surveillance system that's integrated throughout the region and is being rolled out statewide. So we can do a couple ways of looking at the data. We can map it out, which shows you the number of cases by onset date. We also do geocoding, so we can track clustering of illness by address. So we know within the city there originally were some clustering of illness, but right now the disease seems to be pretty well dispersed throughout the city.
Thankfully, there have so far been no swine flu deaths in Wisconsin, but many experts fear that the H1N1 virus is going to come back stronger in the fall. So are you doing anything in anticipation of that?
What we're doing is focusing on case contact management so we can monitor right now the level of disease and keep a good pulse on things over the summer. We're watching guidance coming out of CDC to see if a vaccine would become available. We're really trying to keep a good eye on how severe the illness is, who's getting sick, so that we can really target our strategies should the disease reemerge in the fall.
Well, right now, the WHO, the World Health Organization, is reporting that it's going to take longer than expected to make a swine flu vaccine. And drug manufacturers are saying they're only going to be able to produce enough vaccine to cover 75% of the world's 6.8 billion people. So given that, what does a swine flu tracker do?
I think that's when it's really important to get good data about who's getting sick and the severity of illness so that with limited resources, you can target the individuals who are most likely to have complications. You want to maximize whatever resource you have.
Right. In a way, I'm sure this is what you've prepared your whole life for, you know, to be able to respond to something. How does it feel to be in the middle of it?
Most days it's actually very overwhelming. I think it's kind of somewhat surreal because you spend years planning for things. You have a well thought out plan. And then, you know what, the situation doesn't always conform to the way you plan. So you have to be very adaptable on your toes and be able to very quickly assimilate all the changes in information and guidance. You feel like you're going constantly.
Well, and do you feel, too, like you're working like crazy on something that many Americans are starting to think, false alarm?
I think it's too early in the picture to make that assumption. I'd rather overreact and then have wasted my time than have people come back later on and say, you could have done more to stop all of this.
Angie Hagee, infectious disease epidemiologist and the head swine flu tracker in Milwaukee. Angie, thank you so much.
Sure, no problem.
Announcing an astounding and audacious academic accomplishment, an author's abnormal alliterative addiction, artful absurdity, says Aristophanes, astounding artistry, Aeschylus, another Aeneid, says Aristotle. Well, what we're trying to get at here is about as far as we can go in speaking with words that only begin with A, which is why we are astounded at retired English professor Robert Manson Meyer's accomplishment, a first for the English language, a 200-page book containing only words that start with the letter A. It's a collection of poems, but it also includes an introduction, a biography of the author, even a glossary written entirely in words that start with A. The name of the book, Ars Amatoria, Latin for the Art of Love, and Professor Myers, whose name appears as author anonymous on the book, joins us from WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Professor, welcome.
I'm delighted to be here.
What a project for you. Why write a book with only words that begin with A?
That is, of course, a very reasonable question, and everyone asks it. I luxuriate in strict forms. My dinner parties are always sexually symmetrical. Ooh. No man sits by a man. No woman sits by a woman. I like restriction. And, of course, needless to say, confining myself to 6.25% of the words in the dictionary, that is a confinement.
Yeah.
It's the only letter, I think, that you could achieve this with. A is the only one that gives you any sort of smooth flexibility, as it indeed does. The two lacks, and they are painful lacks. We do not have the definite article the.
Right.
We do not have the preposition of, O-F.
Well, I understand that the original Ars Amatoria, The Art of Love, by Ovid, is quite scandalous. Is your book as scintillating?
There are some rather saucy, naughty bits in my book. I am not young, I'm not modern, and so I might be more shocked than my readers. I think you are going to be equal to this shock.
Okay, let's
hear. I will read you a couple of couplets. These
okay.
are couplets. Arlene's alluring apparatus arouses Algernon's afflatus.
Whoa! Is it going to be scandalous if I ask an afflatus?
I couldn't imagine Robin Young being scandalous. Yes, ask away. And that's A's. I find myself talking in A's all the time.
Well, what's an afflatus? I'm almost afraid to ask
afflatus.
You.
Oh, dear, afflatus. An enthusiasm, zest.
Oh, shoot.
An urgent
okay.
feeling.
Okay.
Algernon's afflatus has been aroused
okay.
by...
The,
and, of course, apparatus is an outrageous word for you-know-what.
Yes.
And that is the source of the humor. There's a great deal of humor here. I have to stand on my head constantly because I can't say it in any other way but with A's.
We understand that you started keeping notes when you were 14 years old.
That's right.
That you would, if you heard a sequence of three or more words beginning in A in a row, you'd write them down.
Yes.
And by the way, we should say you've won the National Book Award in 1972 for The Children of Pride.
That's right.
A collection
that
of letters.
That is the 2,000-page... Civil War.
Wow.
Yes.
Letters from a prominent Georgia family. So you know what you're doing here. How much fun is it?
A great deal.
Yeah.
This is a tour de force, this book. It's a jest. It's a stunt. It was a lot of fun, but let me tell you, it was a lot of work.
Oh, I bet.
You read in 2 minutes might take me 3 weeks. Rewrite. 10 different versions. You
yep.
read it in 10 seconds. Yes.
Well, I'm looking at Adele. It's a rather long poem, but just the first stanza. Adele, an ambidextrous alligator, an absolute abrupt abbreviator, an artful acrobatic amputator, admired as Acme's arch asphyxiator, apprized as Acme's armed assassinator, an ardent arabesque annihilator. Adele.
I am thrilled. You are the first, Robin Young, to give me the pleasure of hearing my lines read. It is a very special experience, you know, to have someone else read your own lines. I must inform the hearers, of the ending of that poem. That's the longest poem in the book. Poor Adele has quite a difficult time. She doesn't like her friend Eileen, and she eats Eileen.
Eileen, the anxious agitator.
Yes, she's a dreadful person, and so Adele eats her. And then, of course, Adele has to pay the price. And the last line, alas, another alligator ate her.
It's just, how long did that one take you?
Oh, it started as a four-line poem. Then it grew. Some of them took me a year. I mean, I would work on them and then lay them aside and come back. When I started, I had, of course, all these notes that I had been saving since prep school days and was preparing to write a whole book of prose. In the morning I started, April 2006, I walked upstairs to my desk and I said, I wonder if it's possible to write a poem. And so I ended up with 190 poems, which makes a book. And so a second book may follow, depending on how eager my readers are, and that will be prose. Huh. And I am now well along on my next book. It's a novel, and I am thrilled to be back to 26 letters of the alphabet. It's a delight.
That's Robert Manson Myers, a retired English professor and avowed Anglomaniac. As he just said, he's got a book coming out that uses all 26 letters of the alphabet. He might write another book in prose using just words that begin with A. And do I understand, Professor, you are 88 years old?
I'm 88, and I plan to live at least another 100 years because I have so many things on my plate. Thank goodness my mind seems to be working, though I suppose my readers are the best judges of that.
Well, Professor, thank you so much, and we just bid you adieu. Anchors away. Amen.
Adieu.
To hear more of Professor Robert Manson Myers' work, go to hereandnow.org.
Seconds, hours, so many days. You know what you want, but I'm locking your way.
Well, yes, it's true. Like everyone else in the universe today, we could not close without congratulating last night's American Idol winner, Chris Allen, the come-from-behind young Christian that many cynical observers thought would play that part in a cultural death match with the other finalist, the eyelinered glam rocker Adam Lambert.
It's been a long, oh, it's been a long time coming.
Instead, the two became obvious friends, and now they take that cross-cultural friendship on the road on the American Idol Summer Tour. Congratulations to both. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.